You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. In our third hour today, I want to lay out for you two things. One, a strategy to knock down the Supreme Court's Citizens United ruling that's actually found and grounded in the Constitution. And two, what we should do, how we should respond as a progressive community if the Supreme Court knocks down Obamacare on Thursday. I actually have a strategy, and I think it's a pretty cool one. So we will be discussing that in our third hour. In our second hour, Phil Kirpin's going to drop by. Phil is now the president of American Commitment, author of Democracy Denied, and he says we should keep the minimum wage right where it is. And I'm saying, you want the economy to work? Jack that thing up. We're going to have a debate about it. But in this hour, I want to talk about why do we have an economy? Right, the most important question that's not being asked in this election cycle. There's a lot of questions being thrown around in this presidential campaign between Mitt Romney and Barack Obama. Questions like, you know, did Romney really create jobs at Bain Capital, or how many did he destroy? Or how much should the super rich pay in taxes? Or where was President Obama really born? Some of these questions are important, and some are completely absurd. And there's a bunch of really fundamental questions that haven't even been asked and that desperately need to be asked if we're ever going to get our economic bearings back. And in fact, the core question, the most important of all these questions, is a question that the late billionaire Sir James Goldsmith asked of Charlie Rose on Charlie Rose's show back in 1994. Here's Goldsmith asking the question.
Can you explain, what is the purpose of an economy in your view?
Okay. So, once again, let's play that a little louder, Shano.
Can you explain, what is the purpose of an economy in your view?
What is the purpose of an economy in your view? And here is Goldsmith answering his own rhetorical question. This is, now, keep in mind, at the time, this man was the richest man on earth. Here you go.
The economy is there to serve the fundamental needs of society.
Yes.
Which are prosperity.
Yes.
Which are stability.
Yes.
And which are contentment.
So, prosperity, stability, and contentment. That's the purpose of an economy. That's why we organize economies. That's why we have governments organized among citizens who create laws that make it possible for companies to have all kinds of cool benefits. You know, they can deduct equipment, they can deduct interest, they can go out, people who are working for these companies can go out to lunch and write it off. You and I pay for it. Why do we do that? Why are we supporting them? Well, very simply, because those companies engaging in commerce will be of benefit to society. As Goldsmith said, prosperity, stability, and contentment. Back in the 1930s, during the Great Depression, did you know that they used to call this the Republican Depression? During Roosevelt's years, it was mostly, he didn't do it so much because he tried not to be all that partisan on this issue, but it was broadly referred to in newspapers and others, not as the Great Depression. That didn't come along until the 40s when the history of the Depression started being written. It was referred to as the Republican Depression. Anyhow, back in the 30s, during the Republican Depression, when prosperity, stability, and contentment were pretty hard to come by, President Franklin Roosevelt thought that he could restore the true purpose of an economy by establishing a good quality of life for as many people as possible. Back in 1936, Roosevelt said, "Necessitous men are not free men. Liberty requires the opportunity to make a living decent according to the standard of the time, a living which gives man not only enough to live by, but something to live for." Roosevelt knew that if someone was hungry and didn't have food, or sick and didn't have medical care, or broke and didn't have a job, then they're not free. But when our economy provides these basic essentials for freedom, then Americans could finally find stability and contentment, giving them a chance to also take entrepreneurial risks and eventually find prosperity as well. Remember Goldsmith's definition of an economy. It's there to provide prosperity, stability, and contentment to the society. So to do just that, in 1944, FDR introduced a second Bill of Rights. Here's his introduction to it.
In our day, certain economic proofs have become accepted as self-evident. A second Bill of Rights, under which a new basis of security and prosperity can be established for all, regardless of station or race or creed.
Right, and so this Bill of Rights is going to establish basically an economic Bill of Rights, an economy that provides for freedom. FDR goes on to lay out a new set of rights that all Americans should be granted. They include the right to a job, which means if a job is a right, if unemployment goes above a certain point, the government steps in as the employer of last resort, as happened in the 1930s. The right to earn enough to provide adequate food, clothing, and recreation to your family. The right of every business person to trade in freedom from unfair competition and domination by monopolies. Boy, we sure have gone far from that. The right to a decent home. He wanted to actually make, now keep in mind, if these things become rights, then we the people can say, okay, you know, we are going to make this happen for us. A right to adequate medical care. We still don't have that. A right to adequate protection from the old age, sickness, accidents, and unemployment. And a right to a good education, excuse me. Roosevelt never succeeded in getting his second Bill of Rights passed. In fact, he died of a stroke, you know, kind of mid through his campaign. But at least his definition of an economy being something that serves the need of the society and provides the best quality of life for the greatest number of people, it was accepted for the next several decades by both Republicans and Democrats who supported labor unions, high taxation on the rich, and a regulated economy that protects American jobs and American industry. Between 1930 and 1980, Americans knew the answer to that fundamental question. Why do we have an economy? What's its purpose? Even Republicans knew it. As Republican Dwight Eisenhower wrote to his brother, "It is quite clear that the federal government cannot avoid or escape responsibilities which the mass of the people firmly believes should be undertaken by it. Should any political party," Republican President Dwight Eisenhower wrote, "should any political party attempt to abolish Social Security, unemployment insurance, and eliminate labor laws and farm programs, you would not hear of that party again in our political history." There's a tiny splinter group, of course, that believes you can do these things. Among them are a few Texas oil millionaires. Their number is negligible, and they are stupid. But then with end of quote. But then with Ronald Reagan came a new answer, one that we're still stuck with today. Rather than an economy serving the needs of society, Reagan and this new breed of supply-side economists and free marketers believed that society exists to serve the needs of an economy. In other words, you and me are here to serve the fat cats. Or more specifically, the society serves the needs of the leaders within an economy, corporations and their CEOs, or as Fox News calls them, job creators, which brought us the greed is good mentality in the 1980s when CEOs were encouraged to cut salaries of their workers, bust up unions, pollute the skies, gamble on Wall Street, all to maximize wealth. Then came laws to cement this new definition of an economy, massive tax cuts for so-called job creators, deregulation of Wall Street banksters, and so-called free trade so national corporations could abandon America and morph into transnational behemoths. You get what's happened here? This fundamental redefinition of what freedom means? I want to continue on this just a little bit on the other side of this break, and then we'll open up a conversation about this topic.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
How has the new Reagan business model of America devastated freedom in our country? Okay, so along with Ronald Reagan came this new idea. right? I was just laying out this new business model, an entirely new definition of an economy, what it is, why it is, how it works. And it came out of that era, and it's still with us. I mean, we're pretty much stuck with this. And this is one in which making money and profit is the goal of an economy, pure and simple. To hell with contentment, stability, prosperity, that stuff doesn't matter. What matters is that people like Mitt Romney can get rich. The freedom to pollute. I mean, this is FDR seriously believed. To FDR, freedom meant freedom from want and destitution. It meant the freedom to step out and do things because you had your basic needs met. That was Franklin Roosevelt. That's what Teddy Roosevelt. I mean, Abraham Lincoln talked like this. This is the historic view of what freedom means in America. But Reagan said, no. Freedom means that you're free to pollute. You're free to outsource. You're free to take risks on Wall Street. Or at least your banksters are free to. You're free to illegally foreclose on millions of Americans. You're free to buy an election. Basically, the freedom to be a pirate equity manager and raid American companies, laying off thousands of workers to maximize profits. Mitt Romney is the walking embodiment of this new definition of freedom, as well as the lead spokesman for the new answer to the question, what is the purpose of an economy? He's running for president on it. He and his donors, like Sheldon Adelson, Karl Rove, and the Koch brothers, they all believe that we have an economy so that he and his buddies can get filthy rich. That's why corporations' share of tax revenue has plummeted since Reagan, while working people's share of tax revenue has increased. That's why the top 1% have seen their income skyrocket 275% since Reagan, yet the rest of us have barely seen our incomes grow. It's why unionization rates have fallen since Reagan, and along with those rates, the middle class's share of income has also dropped. With 49 million Americans in poverty, 45 million Americans on food stamps, 53 million Americans without health insurance, prosperity, stability, and contentment for the vast majority of us, good luck. This is all happening because we failed. We the American people, we failed to take a step back, look around, and ask ourselves just this simple, fundamental question. What's an economy for anyway? Why do we create economies? If progressives are going to take back America, just like they did with Teddy Roosevelt, the Republican Roosevelt in the early 1900s, FDR, the Democratic Roosevelt in the 1930s, then it's imperative we redefine both freedom and the purpose of an economy. And that begins with asking that question, what is freedom? What is the purpose of an economy? Everything else, from universal health care to the rights of working people to regulations on oil barons and banksters, everything else follows from those questions. It's time to get back to earlier definitions of freedom, not as the Koch brothers have redefined it, as their right to pollute and corrupt politicians freely, but as FDR defined it, as the right for Americans to be free to chase their dreams because their basic needs, like health care, education, and a job, are secure. It's time to promote stability and prosperity again by saying the economy is here to serve the needs of society and not to serve the needs of Mitt Romney and his buddies. Let's start asking the right questions. Here's Franklin Roosevelt laying out his vision, you know, his what should be in the second Bill of Rights. Listen.
Among these are the right to a useful and remunerative job, the right to earn enough to provide adequate food and clothing and recreation, the right of every farmer to raise and sell his products at a return which will give him and his family a decent living, the right of every businessman, large and small, to trade in an atmosphere of freedom. Freedom from unfair competition and domination by monopolies at home or abroad. The right of every family to a decent home. The right to adequate medical care and the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health. The right to adequate protection from from the economic fears of old age, sickness, accident, and unemployment, the right to a good education.
It's just very straightforward stuff, right? Franklin Roosevelt is saying these things should be rights. And you know what's amazing? In most of the well-developed countries of the world, they are rights. Everybody can get a decent education in Germany and Sweden and Norway and Finland and Denmark and France. No problem. People can take vacations. People have a voice in the workplace. They have the right to, if their job market collapses, if there's another Republican Great Depression, at least until this austerity woo-woo stuff started, like, you know, a couple of years ago with the election of David Cameron in the UK, and then this sweeping across the parts of Europe anyway, the bankster-driven austerity. It used to be that, you know, government would step in and say, okay, you know, unemployment's above a certain point. We're going to start hiring people. There's always stuff that needs to be done. The right to a job. So that government can say to an employer, you know, you're going to have to conduct yourself in a way that actually keeps jobs in the United States. If you send jobs offshore, overseas, if you do what Romney did with Bain Capital, and what Romney did with the state of Massachusetts, for that matter, when he laid off state workers and hired people in India to answer phones on behalf of the state. If you do that, you're violating people's rights in this country. That's against the law. You can't do that. Roosevelt had a clear vision, and we need to recapture that vision. And the question for the day, or at least for the hour, is how can we get this into the dialogue? How can we get Democrats and Republicans to pick this up?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And how do you define freedom? Now, we know, you know, the Koch brothers define freedom as the freedom to buy politicians. How do you define freedom? Helping you win the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you, 35 minutes past the hour. This is really a key issue. Let me just lay this out. This is an absolute key issue. What does freedom mean? The Republicans have been pounding this idea for three decades now. In fact, a lot of you literally grew up with this. The idea that freedom means that capitalists can do whatever they damn well please without interference from the rest of us when we organize ourselves together into this thing called government. Now, that is not historically how Americans viewed freedom. What does freedom mean to you? How do we change it, that definition of freedom, from you are free to die in the gutter like a rat? Remember the debate where Ron Paul was asked this question? How do we change it from that to you are free to go off and be an entrepreneur or start your own business or do, you know, pursue your dreams because you know that, God forbid, should something happen to you, you know, health-wise, that you're covered, that you can go to any doctor anywhere, any hospital anywhere, get any treatment anywhere, no problem. You're in good shape. That's freedom. Freedom doesn't mean you have the freedom to just like die in this. Anyhow, enough of the rant. John in Minneapolis, the lines are slammed here. John in Minneapolis. You're on the air.
Yes, I just wanted to make the comment that, you know, schools of economics have basically have this orthodox idea that from Milton Friedman, and it's unquestioned, and it's taken over not just schools of economics, but schools of business. It's also really demoted the importance of the humanities and any other school within the university system. And they take, you know, I'm a respiratory therapist. I get a wage. They take a certain amount of my money and they give it to the University of Minnesota. And they also take a certain amount of my money and give it nationwide to support education, which I don't have any problem with.
Who is this they you're talking about?
Undermining, you know, the middle class, and they're undermining.
Who is the they that is taking your money?
Who is taking my money? The state. The state is taking my money.
You mean
they are investing
you're paying taxes?
In universities that are perpetuating.
Okay, you have the wrong villain here, John. The Koch brothers have donated money to over 100 universities around the country, and they donate it with strings attached that you have to give away copies of Atlas Shrugged. You have to teach it as part of the curriculum. You have to any professor gets hired in the university, the Koch brothers get to review. Just Google this. It'll blow your mind. Koch brothers and universities. They have basically, and it's not just them, but I mean, there's other right-wing billionaires who are doing the same thing. And what they're doing is remodeling our education system. You're right. Our college departments of economics in particular have been horribly corrupted by these kinds of things. Paul in Denver. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Oh, I want to ask you a question, Tom.
Yeah.
Why don't they lean more on the mess that Bush made? My God, he started two illegal wars. He turned the banks loose. He turned the mortgage companies loose. And we're all paying for it right now. All people lost their houses and they lost their jobs.
Yeah.
And I can't believe what these Republicans are doing to us.
Yeah, well,
they want to
make
us slave.
I think a lot of people get that. And I personally don't get why Obama doesn't campaign more on I've been cleaning up. You know, I've been the guy in the circus with the shovel behind the elephant here, you know, for the last 3 years. I mean, it's an iconic image. It's this should be it, right? But he's chosen not to. Frankly, Bush for years campaigned against Clinton. I mean, you know, and Reagan spent most of his presidency campaigning against Jimmy Carter, or blaming everything on Jimmy Carter. But you know, people don't remember that, so. Paul in Amory, Mass. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, man. I was listening to your program here, and you're talking about how do we get back to what freedom used to mean.
Yeah.
I think it's very simple. As Americans, we need to take the time to write. I've been doing this for the last 6 months, just going crazy with it, writing congressmen, the president, local people, whoever, and telling them, look back at history, especially during FDR's terms, and see what worked then and what didn't work, and to read some of what he said.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think if they would, Democrat, Republican, Independents, all of them together, then sit down and quit acting like three-year-olds at day camp, arguing, and figure out what's good for all of us. And the second point is, back when taxes used to be high, that gave a businessman an incentive, instead of taking all of his money and putting it in a bank account, to reinvest in another business. That way he could be more wealthier, but it wouldn't be liquid. You know what I'm saying? He couldn't
just
sit down and put his hands on it. He would have
right.
to sell out and get it. And they, you know, that's what he did when he got ready to retire, turn it over to his kids. I mean, he was still just as wealthy, he just
right.
didn't have it.
And this is why small businesses and medium-sized businesses stayed in families for generation after generation after generation, why they were stable. It's why people could get a job and work in that same job for 30 or 40 years until they retired. It's this, it's one simple thing, and that is high top marginal tax rates on income over $1 million a year. That was the thing that kept businesses stable and strong and in America and kept money in those businesses. You are absolutely right. And when Ronald Reagan did away with that in from 83 to 86, you know, systematically taking the top tax rate down from 74% to 28%, he destroyed the future of the American dream. He began the destruction of the American middle class and began the creation of a new plutocratic wealth class, an aristocratic oligarchy that right now is sitting around. Last weekend they were meeting in Utah with Mitt Romney, and they were meeting in San Diego with the Koch brothers, planning how they're going to buy the next elections. And you can thank Ronald Reagan for that. It is so wrong. Paul, thank you for the call. Brenda in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. Brenda, what's up?
Hey, I called yesterday, but I got arthritis in my hand, so I couldn't hold the phone any longer. But I appreciate you calling twos and fours to you and yours.
Thank you.
And I would like to know, are we in a coup?
It depends on your definition of coup, but it seems to me like the rich guys have taken over.
Well, I think we're in a coup to take over the United States without the guns. And the thing of it is, I believe in everything you said. I'm 66 years old, so I've been through the Reagan and hierarchy and all that kind of stuff. I haven't voted since right now. I voted for Obama, and I hope the man has the strength to stand up and know that he's our only hope.
Because well, it's not. He's
here. We're doomed.
Brenda, I am very thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. I am very concerned that if Romney gets in, we're going to lose the Supreme Court and we'll be doomed. And we may get in stupid wars and we're going to see more, you know, deficit spending because that's what Republicans always do. All those kinds of things. But the big concern, I would not say Obama is our savior. Nobody is. We are our savior. That's the whole idea of America. This is what, you know, this is what George Washington had. Was he had an energized populace that was willing to go to war against the British. This is what Abraham Lincoln had. He had an energized populace that was willing to go to war to keep the republic together. This is what Teddy Roosevelt had. He had an energized populace, a progressive revolution that was willing to support him in calling out the big corporations. In 1907, passing the Tillman Act that made it a federal felony to give, for a corporation to give money to a politician. That in breaking up Standard Oil into 27 or 28 companies and in you know being the trust buster, he had the wind behind his back of the people. It's what Franklin Roosevelt had. He had the Bonus Army. He had the Occupy movement that was occupying from the White House all the way down to the Potomac River. And it's what Lyndon Johnson had. He had the Civil Rights movement, and he had well, and ultimately the anti-war movement that Richard Nixon exploited. You know, saying, yes, I'll end the war, just elect me, ha, ha, ha. It was ultimately Gerry Ford who did it. But nonetheless, there were people in the streets that made it possible for these presidents to do these things. So if you want Obama to bring about a second Bill of Rights, like Franklin Roosevelt laid out, then we have to be there behind him. We have to be the ones, you know, making all this happen. Mike in Chicago. Hey, Mike, what's up? Got a minute to the break.
Real quick, we got all the Republicans whining and complaining about how much it costs, how much everybody gets paid at the colleges. Well, our wonderful Governor Mitch Daniels is announcing that he's going to be the new president of Purdue University when he gets out of office this year.
Wow. So it's kind of ironic that the Republicans like Mitch Daniels are complaining about how much the presidents of the universities make, and then he goes off to be one. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, well, it doesn't surprise me. Mitch Daniels, you know, I mean, these guys, this is their. Thank you, Mike, for the call. This is the Republican idea of public service, is you use, you know, whether you're in a regulatory position or whether you're in Congress or whether you're a governor, whatever it is, use it as a stepping stone to private wealth. This isn't how it used to be. Jimmy Carter didn't get rich after leaving the White House. Harry Truman didn't get rich after leaving the White House. He drove home to Missouri. Lived in a modest home. Lived on a pension. You know, Reagan, Bush, these guys, it's like, how to get rich after you leave the White House? Well, Clinton too. It shouldn't be. We'll be back 46 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So what does freedom mean to you? To me, it means the freedom to step off and take risks.
That's the way you do money for nothing.
Welcome back to Talk Media for the sane among us, Tom Hartman Program. Dan in Los Angeles. Hey, Dan, what's on your mind today? Dan?
Yeah, hey, Tom.
Hey, what's up?
Get this country back on track and get our jobs back. Why don't we push for laws to make all imports have to be made under the same environmental and labor laws that we have to abide by?
Yeah, that's a good start. That's a good start. And, you know, and in fact, I would even take it beyond that. I would say, let's just blow up these trade deals or, you know, yeah, you can enforce environmental standards and things like that. But I would like to see a return to tariffs. You know, where we simply say, if you want to bring something into this country, if the way it used to be, I used to use shoes as the example all the time. It's really easily understood that if there's a dollar's worth of labor in a $15 pair of shoes made in the United States, and you want to make those shoes in Mexico, where it's 50 cents worth of labor, you want to make them in Vietnam, where it's 20 cents worth of labor, when they hit the shore of the United States, if they come from Mexico, there's a 50 cent tariff. If they come from Vietnam, there's an 80 cent tariff. So no matter what, you're going to pay the dollar. You might as well pay it to laborers here in the United States as someplace else, because that labor cost is going to be absorbed. And if there's environmental costs, the same thing. If you can pour out pollution in Mexico or in Vietnam and that you couldn't do legally here, then you assign a dollar value to that and simply apply it as a tariff. And that way you don't even need the regulations and rules. You don't need to have somebody going around inspecting sites and making sure factories are right and all that kind of thing. It becomes very simple. I mean, this is the way that the George Washington administration laid it out, and these kind of trade rules were in place up until the Reagan administration. Ronald Reagan started deconstructing them, and then it went on steroids in the 1980s with the NAFTA and CAFTA, or in the 1990s, NAFTA, CAFTA, SHAFTA, all the free trade agreements. But, Dan, excellent point. Thank you for calling, and thank you for making it. James in Chicago. Hey, James, what's up?
How you doing, Tom? I am a conservative, and I just like to give, you know, my point of view, and I'd like to hear what you have to say.
Okay.
To what I have to say. First of all, you're talking about supply-side economics, and obviously, you know, one of the major tenets of that is that, you know, a reduction in the top rates of wealthy Americans will result in an increase in tax revenues.
Which has never been demonstrated to work.
Well, I would like to give an example of where I have seen that work. I was reading, and it was saying that in 1979, the top 0.01% paid about 2.7% of the overall amount of taxes. So that's just the 0.01%. And today, I believe the tax rate is about 10 points lower, give or take, might be more, might be less. But it's definitely lower, and today they're paying about 6.5% of the overall taxes, which, in my opinion, proves that even though that the tax rate has gone down for them, they're still contributing significantly more money.
James, they've suckered you. They didn't give you the statistics about the growth of wealth or income for that top one-tenth of 1%, did they?
No.
No, they didn't. The top 1% of Americans since Reagan's presidency to today have seen a 275% increase in their income, that is, in the dollars that they're getting. And we have now, and the average working person has seen about a 2% decrease during those 30 years. It would have been about a 1% increase if it wasn't for the Bush Great Recession. So basically, the rest of us got stuck with nothing, you know, got nothing. The rich got vastly richer. Now, of course, if you get vastly richer, even if you're paying a lower tax rate, there's going to be more tax revenue. The other thing is that if you look back in the 1950s, the 1960s, the 1970s, you know, before Reagan, again, before supply-side economics, the average person, the average CEO was making between 30 and 32 times what their janitors were making. Okay, so the average CEO, I mean, it was very rare that any CEO made over $1 million in today's dollars, inflation adjusted for today. Because if they did, they started paying 74% income tax. So what they did was they kept the money in the company. And what this did was it caused incredible stability. You had people who literally started in the mailroom at General Motors and ended up as the CEO. They worked in the company for 40 years. And in addition to that, they kept the company's money in the company. Because why take it out? You get taxed on it. Whether it's General Motors or whether it's, you know, the local furniture store. When Reagan dropped that top tax rate, these very wealthy people started pulling money out like crazy, hot money, and were looking for places to gamble with it. And thus, you know, bubbles. We had the dot-com bubble, we had the bank bubble, we've had the real estate bubble. All of these bubbles are the result of hot money in our economy. But now we have a situation where one family, five heirs of Sam Walton, one family own more wealth than you know, the bottom third of America, where the top 400 wealthiest people, just 400 people, the Forbes 400, 400 people own more wealth than half of America, than 150 million other Americans. And half of those 400 people paid no income taxes last year. That's the other half of the equation that you're not seeing in those statistics. And that's a classic example of, you know, figures don't lie, but liars can figure. Supply side economics doesn't work. It's a really simple equation. Supply side, first of all, that's not even supply side economics. That's some crazy idea that Art Laffer had on with a curve on a napkin. That's Laffer curve economics that Reagan adopted. Supply side economics says, okay, the classic economic theory that was first really well articulated by Adam Smith in Wealth of Nations in 1776 and in his book Theory of Moral Sentiments, says that demand is what drives an economy. The more people you have to buy something, the more the economy is going to grow and the more entrepreneurs are going to step in to meet that demand. And everybody understood that right up until the 1980s when Reagan came along and said, demand, you know, and the idea was always, it's because demand drives an economy, we want to put more and more money into working people's pockets because working people spend 100% of the money they get. And that thus they create demand. Whereas if you give extra money to rich people, it doesn't create demand. They put it in a Swiss bank account. Romney's got a Swiss bank account. He's got a Cayman's bank account. He's got all these foreign. His kids have $100 million in a trust fund. It's doing nothing. It's going nowhere. It is not creating demand. And so Reagan, having to confront this problem that everybody understood that, you know, the economy was driven by working people having money in their pockets, said, no. It's rich people having money in their pockets, and it's supply that's driving things. He was wrong. History has proven him wrong. Thanks for the call, James. Good luck.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So we were talking about supply side economics and other various fantasies in the last part of the last hour, and one of the more outspoken and thoughtful commentators on these issues, Phil Kirpin, president of American Commitment, AmericanCommitment.org, is on the line with us. Phil, welcome back to the program.
Oh, thank you, Tom, and kind of you to call me one of your more thoughtful ideological opponents. I appreciate that.
You're welcome. I literally have some people who scream at me on the show. I appreciate your rationality. The let's talk about the minimum wage here. In the last half of the last hour, I got a call from a conservative who identified himself as such and said that his understanding was that supply side economics helped tremendously. Because of some magical thing. I'm not sure I get it. Having read Adam Smith and a lot of economists, Desuet de Tracy, I mean, you know, a lot of the 17th, 18th century economists right up to today, I don't understand why you think that raising the minimum wage, putting more money in the pockets of working people who will spend 100% of that money, wouldn't stimulate the economy more than giving another tax break to Mitt Romney so he can put more money in a Swiss bank account, which is going to do nothing for our economy.
Well, the problem is that when you raise the minimum wage, you price people at the low end out of the labor market, and that's why we've got teenage unemployment right now at 24.6%. And there was a compelling study by Casey Mulligan, an economist from the University of Chicago, that found that the 36% increase in the minimum wage after adjusting for inflation that happened since 2006 cost us about 800,000 jobs. And that's not something I believe we can afford to do, especially in such a weak economy where, you know, if people
you want to have dueling studies
as not working at all.
As you know, Travis Waldron published this piece. You've got a copy of it, looking at the impact of minimum wage, increasing the minimum wage on employment levels. And there isn't any. And in fact, I don't have it right in front of me. I printed it out back about a year ago for one of these debates. And just, you know, minimum wage, unemployment levels and growth of GDP from, you know, starting back in the 40s, I guess, the late 30s, early 40s, when the minimum wage was first introduced, right up to today. And you can't find any trends in there. This is the reason why nobody can say definitively, here's the data, because the minimum wage doesn't have an effect on unemployment. And what's pricing is the wrong word. What's keeping teenagers out of the labor market is that they don't have the skill set. We have an economy right now that sucks so badly because there's no demand. and therefore people aren't being hired. And so the employers, if given the choice of hiring a 17-year-old who has no experience or hiring a 20- or 30-year-old who's been doing a job for a number of years, we'll take the 20- or 30-year-old or 40- or 50-year-old.
Well, I would disagree with that as an empirical question. I think there's a pretty strong consensus among economists across the ideological spectrum, including folks like Larry Summers on the left.
Larry Summers is a right-wing crazy.
Well, okay, I forgot that you considered him to be of the right, but there's a pretty strong consensus in the economics profession that for every 10% increase in the minimum wage, you get about a 1% increase.
There is no such consensus, Phil.
The market. I mean,
you're pulling this out of your left ear. There is
no such
consensus.
I think you look at Larry Summers' work. I think you look at, again, people like Casey Mulligan, more recent work. There's a pretty strong empirical relationship there. And think about it. If you say it's now illegal for a willing buyer to meet a willing seller, for someone to hire someone who wants to work at a given wage, a lot of those transactions will no longer make economic sense. They're no longer possible.
You're absolutely right. Which brings us back to the big question that I was asking in the last hour, which is, what is the purpose of an economy? Why do you think that we have an economy?
To efficiently allocate resources and allow people to express their own subjective preferences and maximize their individual utility, to have people make their own decisions and have the happiest lives they can have.
Okay, here's what Sir James Goldsmith, at the time the richest man on earth, said in 1994 to Charlie Rose when asked that question.
The economy is there to serve the fundamental needs of society.
Yes.
Which are prosperity.
Yes.
Which are stability.
Yes.
And which are contentment.
Prosperity, stability, and contentment. The economy is here to serve society. What you're suggesting is that society is here to serve the economy.
No, I'm not saying that at all.
Okay, if the economy is here to serve society, then, and the rules for the economy are established by we the people through government. We create the laws. We define, you know, what a company can do and can't do. You know, what their tax rates are, pretty much everything. You know, we are the rule keepers for the football field, right? And then, you know, and the referees. So why shouldn't we create a rule that says if you can't pay somebody a reasonable wage so that they can actually live and be happy and fulfilled, as you were talking about, if you can't pay somebody that wage, then you've got a lousy business model and a stupid idea, and there's no place for it in our economy. Thank you very much. Go someplace else.
Because I don't trust politicians and bureaucrats to determine what that wage ought to be, and we've got no way to determine where wage levels should be other than to have willing buyers and willing sellers make those agreements themselves and to determine that in a market way.
But that logic, Phil, that was the logic that stood during Victorian England. I mean, that was the logic that kind of logic is what produces a large class of the working poor and a small class of rich people who get to decide that they're going to make contracts with you. How can one individually possibly make a contract with a multi-billion-dollar corporation and have anybody, any rational person, think that that's two willing parties?
Well, because if you don't want to enter into that agreement, go work somewhere else or start your own business or what have you. The problem we have
is
a terrible economy where it's very difficult to do that for a number of reasons, some of which we agree on and many of which I'm sure we disagree on. But, Tom, if you could make people wealthier by raising the minimum wage by government dictate, why don't we make it, you know, $300 an hour and make everyone rich? The point is, if you have the wage too high,
that's a straw man argument.
People can't work because their labor is not worth that.
My suggestion, I'm talking about,
is very challenging. I'd be interested if you still support. You know, in the past, we've come to agreement on this idea that there ought to be an expanded teenage training wage. The one that exists right now is very difficult for businesses.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. We can stipulate that. But let's go back to this. Core concept. Please don't filibuster me, Phil.
Unemployment. That would be a wonderful thing, especially as we're going into summer now.
Phil, I was not suggesting you started this whole long filibuster out with Tom. If you want the minimum wage to make people rich, I never suggested that. What I'm suggesting is that increasing the minimum wage will increase demand in the economy. That money will go directly, as soon as you pay minimum wage employees, they spend the money. That money goes directly into the economy, stimulates demand, which makes more demand for goods and services, which makes more business people able to deliver more goods and services, which means ultimately they're going to have to hire more people. In other words, it stimulates the economy. And that's, and Republicans know that as well as Democrats. And that's why Republicans have been blocking any attempt to raise the minimum wage, because it would stimulate the economy and put people back to work.
Well, we had one of the biggest increases in the minimum wage in history that took effect between 2006 and 2009, and I don't think...
Not in real dollars. For the minimum wage right now to be where it was in 1967, it would have to be $10.
Since 2006, it's 36% higher adjusted for inflation.
Since 2006, okay.
That you've suggested. Instead, we've got teenage unemployment at 25%.
And we so have... This has nothing to do with the minimum wage. You're mixing apples and oranges. You're saying that the Bush crash, which was the result of our deregulating the banksters, is not to account for unemployment. My point is that if the minimum wage went up that much in 2006, then gee, things must have been pretty good in 2007, and I recall they were.
Well, it was phased in over 3 years in three steps from 515 up to 7.25, which is where it is right now. The principal economic effect of that has been to put a lot of teenagers out of the possibility of having those summer jobs. It's very high.
The minimum wage is still not where it was in the 1960s, Phil.
Tom, you're not going to, even if you boost aggregate demand in terms of stimulating people buying, it's just going to go into corporate profits. Companies are not going to actually invest in new workers and expand until they have some stability in the regulatory and tax environment, which they don't have right now.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Phil Kirpin, and the website now is AmericanCommitment.org. Thanks, Phil. Normally I don't speak about my guests when they're not here to defend themselves, but Phil was pretty aggressive about trying to filibuster me, and I let him get this long riff in at the very end where he said even if the minimum wage did increase aggregate demand, A, the corporations would take all that additional revenue and profits, which is not what I was talking about. What I was talking about is when you increase demand, you increase supply. And to increase supply, you have to hire more people. So you increase jobs. So A, he's wrong. And then B, he said, and of course, nobody's going to hire in this regulatory environment. Nonsense. This regulatory environment is not much different than the regulatory environment over, you know, since Nixon and the EPA. In fact, if anything, it's gotten a lot slacker. It's gotten a lot easier for big corporations to buy regulators, to buy off rules and regulations. It's you know, I get it that the Koch brothers want to be able to pollute more, that Halliburton, you know, wants to be able to frack more. You know, I get it, but they're doing just fine, thank you very much. And to say that we should have an economy and not say to working people, we're not gonna give you entrance into the American dream. And the American dream being not, hey, you two can hit it rich like Mitt Romney. Of course, you have to be born the son of a multimillionaire to do that. The United States, by the way, is the least economically mobile country in the developed world. When Reagan came into office, we were the most economically mobile country. In other words, when Reagan came into office, you had the probability of ending up outside of an economic class higher than your parents, outperforming your parents, so much so that you actually change economic classes. It was the highest. The United States was the highest in the world when Reagan came into office. Today, we are the lowest in the developed world, among the 34 OECD countries, the wealthy nations. And when you get into the poor nations, the statistics don't mean much because you've got a lot of poor people, and one guy pops into a billionaire and suddenly, you know, the statistics are meaningless. But when you're comparing apples to apples, we have become the most rigid or one of the two most rigid countries in the world in terms of the ability to, if you're defining the American dream as, you know, hitting the jackpot. I always define the American dream as my dad's life. My dad worked in a tool and die shop for 40 years. During that time, he bought a new car every 2 years. He took 2 weeks vacation every year. some years 3 weeks, depending on what his union could negotiate. He had a good wage. He raised four boys. He owned his house when he died, free and clear. He had a pension that paid for him and my mom until she died. That was the American dream for them. They had a good, high-quality life. Why should we say to workers, no, no, we're going to make sure that the CEOs get their millions and billions. The fat cat executives get their money, but the workers who actually make the product, I mean, without whom there would be no product or no service, the workers, screw them. We really need to be talking about this stuff. Donna in Quincy, Mass. Hey, Donna, what's up?
Hey, Tom, what a pleasure to talk to you. I've admired you for years.
Thank you.
Thank you for doing what you do. I'm a professor, and I teach media ethics and media history. And when I was listening on hold to your previous caller, I kept thinking of that Thomas Frank book, the new book, Pity the Billionaire.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like all these poor billionaires, we can't raise taxes on the job creators.
Right.
Excuse me, corporate profits are through the roof, but right. You know, they're the poor.
They're at an all-time high in America right now. We haven't seen corporate profits this high since the 1920s and the 1880s.
Yeah, and it's not trickling down, but keep it under your hat. Don't tell anyone.
Yeah.
Okay. What got me calling was I'm working on a project, and I started thinking, I don't know about you, but I'm a baby boomer, and I was thinking about how attitudes have changed among corporate executives. I live in Boston, and I'm looking at this beautiful public library that was built by the rich so that the new immigrants and the lower and middle class could be uplifted by all these beautiful sculptures and paintings and things like that. And then I find a document by Edward Filene. I don't know if you're familiar with the old Filene's department store.
Sure.
Okay, well, Edward Filene writes this guide in 1922. I have a copy of it. It's not some urban legend I found online. And in it, he says, as a business owner, I have a duty. And he uses the word duty. I have a duty to my employees to provide them with humane living and working conditions and to provide them with an environment where they feel good about their jobs. He said, that is my duty, and that will ensure that they will be more productive.
Right.
Now, can you imagine an owner of a business today, a giant conglomerate today, saying, I have a duty to make sure that my workers have a humane working condition and to make sure that they're treated well so that they'll be more productive?
No, in fact, if anything, have you seen the new ad from the Obama campaign about Mitt Romney at Bain?
Yes.
I mean,
I lived Mitt Romney. He was my governor.
Oh, okay? Boy, you have my empathy.
2 years. The guy spent 2 years running for office, making fun of and insulting those of us in Massachusetts,
right,
which I took a rather dim view of.
Yes. Yeah.
It's the man's a phony.
Yeah. But in answer to your rhetorical question, no, I can't imagine the modern day conservatives or the modern day business people saying that they have a duty to their employees. And this is, you know, in part the globalization, in part just this royalization, this mentality that came along with Reagan go ahead.
It's a lack of ethics, Tom. I'm very serious. We have a whole bunch of people huffing and puffing about how religious they are. I don't care if you're Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, Hindu, Buddhist, secular, humanist. Whatever happened to ethics? Whatever happened to believing that you have an ethical obligation to the people that are working for you to treat them well?
Well, and as Filene said, it makes them more productive. Right? I mean, there's even some enlightened self-interest in there. Thank you very much, Donna, for the call. Brilliant commentary. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So how do we go about building an economy that works for all? It's got to start with new language. More afterwards. Okay, there's apparently a whole series of different versions of this. The first one that I saw earlier today, and I haven't been able to quickly find it again on the internet here, is starts out with a quote from Mitt Romney saying that on day one he's going to take on China. This ad that's over at the New York Times blog is just a Virginia version of that they're playing in Virginia, where Romney had come to Virginia and said he was going to start with jobs as his number one priority. This is the new ad that the president's campaign has.
Barack Obama and I approve this message.
President Romney's first 100 days, creating thousands of new jobs for Virginians.
But would he? The Washington Post has just revealed that Romney's companies were pioneers in shipping U.S. jobs overseas, investing in firms that specialized in relocating jobs done by American workers to new facilities in low-wage countries like China and India. Does Virginia really want an outsourcer-in-chief in the White House?
An outsourcer-in-chief? That's just my, for example, answer to the earlier caller who was saying, you know, what would the CEOs say? Well, yeah. Anyhow, Mac in Portland, Maine. Hey, Mac, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Your conversation about the minimum wage, I had a little experience with that. I was in the legislature in Maine in 1989, and we passed the minimum wage increase of 20 cents. 10 cents the first year, and then 10 cents the second year.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a gentleman who owned three McDonald's restaurants, and he came in, and it was going to put him right out of business and so forth and so on. Well, we passed the law, and it was signed into law. The following year, we come back to look at the second 10 cents of the increase, and the same gentleman showed up and told how horrible it would be if we give people another 10 cents.
Mm-hmm.
And in questioning him, he admitted that he went up 3 cents, I believe it was, on each sandwich he sold.
Mm-hmm.
And really had no problem paying the people. And we asked him how much his income went up. Well, 3 cents a sandwich, even paying 10 cents more, he made $28,000 more. So, you know.
Nice work if you can get it.
Really tough. And, because these were all kids, probably 17, 18 years old. So they weren't making much.
Yeah. But the bottom line is that they're when people earning minimum wage, when people at the bottom of the economic ladder make a little bit more, that's an immediate shot in the arm for the economy because they spend it all.
It is, and it's also an immediate shot for the people who are paying minimum wage because those are the people that get the benefit of it.
Yeah.
You know, the kids go to McDonald's, and that's...
Yeah, but by and large, or at least historically in America, the minimum wage employers, most of their customers were minimum wage employees. So you're back to the Henry Ford thing of you know, he went from paying his employees a dollar a day to $5 a day, or maybe it was a week, whatever it was, so that they'd be able to buy the cars that he made. Hey, let's expand the marketplace. Mac, excellent. Thank you very much for the call. Well said. Francine in Los Angeles. Hey, Francine, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Great show today.
Thank you.
I just wanted to add on to what you said earlier about people getting involved in order to push for the legislation that they want. And I just wanted to mention the two presidents that you talk about a lot, LBJ and FDR, both had really strong majorities in the Senate. And so it's really important for people to remember to vote in midterms and to remember Congress, not just to think about the presidential race.
Yeah. And there's a couple of senators. Sherrod Brown is probably the one that is being pummeled the hardest. The right wing, the Koch brothers and their buddies have spent already millions of dollars in Ohio trying to destroy Senator Sherrod Brown. And so SherrodBrown.com is his website, just a heads up. Bernie, they're going to be coming after him. His website is Bernie.org. There's some good progressives in the United States Senate who are really looking at a hard time this year. So,
and that majority is so important. I think Johnson had 69 Democratic senators. And
he had a lot. But see, what that says is, again, that's a symptom, not a cause. It's a symptom of the fact that the people were with him. There was a social movement that was pushing for progressive reform in the United States. And therefore, he had all these senators, and therefore, he had all these people behind him. And we need to be that movement. We need to be the movement, as you correctly point out, not only elects a president, but elects a Senate and a House of Representatives. Right. And we've got to get out there and get active to do it. Francine, thank you for the call. Very well said and much appreciated. Sam in Stone Mountain, Georgia. Hey, Sam, what's up?
How are you, Tom? I want to ask you a question, but I want to give an answer, let you know. I paid yesterday my my pledge for the free speech, so I'm part owner now.
Oh, that's great. You're a member of Free Speech TV.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Also, I'm going to pledge my wife and my cousin.
Great.
And now my question.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 60 years old, and when I was going to school, young, they had the where you can buy bonds, saving bonds. Whatever happened to those? What can they do for the country now? And you just don't hear about them anymore. They used to advertise.
You can still buy them. And you can buy them online at the Treasury Department's website, or at least you could a couple of years ago. It's been a while since I've looked. But my dad used to give me a savings bond every year all his life. That was, he gave savings bonds to his kids on their birthdays. And I think the minimum denomination now is $100 and the maximum is $10,000. And they've got a couple of different kinds. They've got one that's inflation adjusted. They've got one that's just a straight, particular interest rate. And there's a couple of different kinds, and I'm not well educated enough to tell you, but what you're remembering and what I remember from, being in elementary school in the 50s was kind of the remnant of the war bonds thing, the stuff that our parents remembered, where you could literally,
right.
Bring 10 cents to school and contribute
right.
toward a war bond
right.
kind of thing. And then that
right.
kind of morphed after the war into the March of Dimes, where the schools were collecting money to end polio. And then polio got ended in the 60s, and the whole thing kind of fell apart. But you can still buy savings bonds, and it's a way of investing in your country and having something that's a solid and stable investment that you will get the money back. So it also used to be that banks could sell them. And so the banks would, promote them because they made a small commission on them. And I'm pretty sure that banks can't sell them anymore, although I may be wrong on that, but I don't think that they can. Or what's happened is that the banks now can sell their own investment vehicles that are so much more profitable for the banks. Yeah, when you and I were kids, you'd walk into a bank and you'd see a big sign that says buy U.S. savings bonds.
Correct.
You don't
correct.
See that anymore because, the banks have other things they want you to buy. So.
All right. Thank
excuse
you
me.
For that, Tom.
Thank you, Sam. Thank you for the call and your kind words. Great to hear from you. Natalie in Auburn, Alabama. Hey, Natalie, what's up?
Good afternoon, Tom. I wanted to talk about the idea of enslavement. Do you think that with the state of the economy now that the people have almost enslaved themselves to their jobs and they don't have an opportunity to move from job to job and they don't have an opportunity to move to a new town? Kind of what you were talking about, a necessitous man is not a free man.
Yes.
And there's this idea that money equals speech. So maybe they say free speech equals money. Well, if you don't have any money to do anything to raise your family, are they limiting your free speech?
Yeah, if you try going down that rabbit hole, you will get hopelessly lost. Because the logic that Scalia and these guys use is totally bizarre. The idea of enslavement, I think, is a really important one because slavery, obviously we don't want to minimize the horrors of slavery within the history of the United States. Or to this day, a couple of friends of mine right now are in South Sudan trying to work with slaves, people who have escaped from North Sudan who were taken slaves. The mostly Arab North Sudan raids the mostly African South Sudan regularly and takes people literally as slaves. It's happening right now today. But that said, the core element of slavery is a lack of personal power, a lack of choice, a lack of other options. You must do this. And this was, the debate that I was having with Phil, where he said, you know, there shouldn't be any minimum wage, or if there is, it should be very, very low, because you don't want to interfere with the right of people to contract with each other. Well, I'm all in favor of the right of people to contract with each other, but I don't see where a single employee contracting with a $1 billion corporation with an army of lawyers and you know, the ability to slap them down and chase them to the ends of the earth if they do something wrong, how that could possibly be an even field negotiation.
Yes, that's right.
And so I wouldn't use the word slavery to describe it, because I think that it's, you know, it's like using the Nazi metaphor. There may be a lot of truth to it, but it diminishes the horrors that were associated with the real circumstance. And that's part of the problem, is we don't have a good phrase for it. I mean, you know, back in the 60s, the phrase wage slave was popular, but it kind of became politically incorrect because it was, again, misusing that the slave word. But we should come up with something. I don't know what the word would be, Natalie, but your concept, I think, is spot on. Thank you very much for the thoughtful call. I appreciate it. We'll be right back. 46 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more about how we can make this country work. Right after this. Speaking the truth to multinational corporations, we'd really rather you didn't know all about. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. And Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service is on the line with us. This Talk Radio News Service report, by the way, brought to you by the German Embassy, which wants you to know that Germany supports the European strategy to strengthen the euro through fiscal stability, solidarity, and growth. You can learn more online at germany.info. Hey, Bob.
How are you, Tom?
I am great, but I'll get better. I hope the same is true of you.
Yeah, it is.
Okay, so what's going on in the world?
A lot. On the world level, the Muslim Brotherhood has made it very clear it is going to have a, quote, strategic relationship with Iran. Now, you know, how we define that, I'm not sure at this point, but it's going to just morph our entire way that we have dealt for years with our relationship with Egypt. So Anwar Sadat's nephew, ironically, must be on the other side of his uncle, and he was actually on a panel. So he was just saying, you know, there's got to be a different approach.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something to watch with caution. Of course, Syria, things have continued to escalate within 6 miles of the capital of Damascus with the insurgents. And
whoa.
Yeah.
It's not good news for Assad.
No, it's not. And, of course, the Russians, that whole issue of the helicopters has surfaced over and over. People are trying diplomatic approaches, but it's just a very intense situation over there.
Yeah.
With it.
Yeah.
Supreme Court, as you know, went through a plethora of rulings. One federal court, by the way, that hasn't got a lot of attention, it's a federal appeals court. It's important, though. It upheld the Environmental Protection Agency greenhouse gas regulations, which is a big victory for the Obama administration. Now, it's going to inflame some election year rhetoric, but it's, I think, a pretty big victory.
Now, I'm sorry, I must have missed a word or two there. What happened?
It was the Green Gas. The federal appeals court upheld the EPA's greenhouse gas regulations.
Oh, okay.
Yes. And it wasn't Supreme Court, but it was an appeals court,
right,
which it strikes a big victory,
yeah,
for the Obama administration with it. And
it's got to unanimous. Terrify the fossil fuel industry.
Oh, absolutely. And, of course, you'll hear a lot of rhetoric and, you know, about the jobs and what's going on and,
right,
and that. But it's a good ruling. It's an 82-page ruling. It was unanimous, which I think says a lot for the way they wrote it.
Which circuit was this?
It was, I should know that. It was, the District of Columbia.
Oh, it's the First Circuit.
Yes.
Wow.
District of Columbia Circuit.
And that's a conservative court.
That is a conservative, and it's unanimous decision.
Wow.
Yeah, so that was a big deal, I think.
Scalia will still take it on.
Yeah, of course.
He doesn't give a rat's patootie.
You know? Now, taking on each other, there's a 50-50 chance of a highway bill,
mm-hmm,
which makes no sense why the House will not go along with it, except that the neocons have got their feathers up on this one.
No, there's a reason here, Bob. If that bill, if highway funding is not renewed, then almost immediately in the month of July, 1.9 million people get laid off. 1.9 million people get laid off. Unemployment goes from 8.2% up to 9%, and Obama loses the election. That's the math that they're doing in the House of Representatives.
Uh, Let's see if it turns on them themselves. They take a real risk with it of hurting public policy. This is going beyond repair, Tom, with this, because if they don't move on these projects die.
Right.
So if they play politics on this one, it's not a good thing at all. Playing politics, Congressman Issa, whichever way you want to call him, is escalating this directly to the president. Ironically, he's going to have, you know, his move on Thursday, which is the health care announcement also,
right,
from the Supreme Court. Everybody's trying to take a bet on that one.
Yep. In trade is 75% roughly that the individual mandate is going to get knocked down.
Mm-hmm. At that point in time, I would not be surprised. I mean, if I were President Obama, I'd say to the Republicans, what now?
Yeah.
You know, it's gone. What do you want to do?
Well, I have a strategy for him. I'm going to lay it out in the next hour. But I think that it's opening up a lot of possibilities.
I think it's going to be struck down. But at the end of the day, it could open up possibilities to force some issues out there, I think.
Yep.
Senator Murray is taking the position. Senator Patty Murray of Washington is saying, look, we had a bipartisan support in the compromise with the Violence Against Women Act, and all of a sudden now there's talk in the House of excluding the measures for Native American women, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, immigrant victims of domestic violence.
Wait a minute. The Republicans are saying it's against the law to beat up white women, but not anybody, but all other women are fair game.
It's starting to go that direction. And this passed, 2 months ago in the Senate by 68-31 vote. And so she's saying that she's not going to compromise. This was bipartisan.
Right.
Why should she compromise? And I think she makes a good point. This is, with the women's issues and the Republicans' hits on this, I would be shocked if they are dumb enough to, take this battle on, too.
Yeah, although they have already in the House. I mean, have they not?
They have, and now she's saying, look, I'm not going to compromise. If you people are talking about this, it's not going to happen.
Right.
So the whole bill's going down.
Amazing.
That happens.
Amazing.
And, of course, the health care ruling is expected, and the juvenile life without parole issue, the court spoke on that one.
Mm-hmm. Does that cause cases where juveniles have gotten life without parole to have to be reheard? Or, I mean, I can't believe it means that they just pop out of jail tomorrow.
I don't think they pop. I think they would have to take an individual case basis. I'm not an attorney, but
right.
I think that would have to do that, because the crack cocaine, when it was leveled to the same offense as powder, then they had to do, case by case. They didn't just open it up and say go.
Right.
But they did a case by case.
Okay.
There's 2,500 pending cases.
Wow, that's a lot.
Uh-huh.
That's a lot of kids. That's amazing.
It is. A lot.
Yeah.
So, pretty busy this week. Everybody's trying to, of course, wrap it up for the summer and go home and stake out their turf battles. The one other case, which was fascinating, didn't get much attention, but the Montana decision with the Supreme Court, which ties into the whole, campaign finance reform and money spending. Montana was overturned and corporate contributions are allowed. The court has spoke on that, the Supreme Court.
Yep.
So it looks like it's going in the spend more money.
Yeah, and the Copper Kings will rise again.
Absolutely.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Bob Nay. Bob, thanks so much
Thank
for being
you.
With us today. The Talk Radio News Service. This Talk Radio News Service report brought to you by the German Embassy, which wants you to know that the European strategy is strengthened, that they support the European strategy to strengthen the euro through fiscal solidarity, stability, and growth. You can learn more online at germany.info. And coming up next, how should the president respond if SCOTUS knocks down Obamacare?
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, here's what I want to lay out. Just my rant for this hour. Obamacare is before the Supreme Court. Shano is telling us that when he was there yesterday, was it? Yeah, yesterday. That the Alito and Scalia were particularly snappy. Is that a good word? Yeah, we won't use that word on the air. But, yeah, they didn't seem happy. And in all probability, a lot of court observers are saying, you know, this is going to be a compromise decision. There's going to be a bunch of 5-4 pieces to it. Probably the individual mandate will fall on a 5-4 decision. And probably many of the other provisions of Obamacare will be sustained on a 5-4 decision, which is going to create a real mess. Because without the mandate, without everybody in, without all those healthy people who don't have health insurance right now, paying a little bit, having some skin in the game, there's not a game. So here's my take on this. Healthcare and health insurance, which are provided via a mandate, like Obamacare does, have a long history. Some people think that mandates like this, healthcare mandates, originate with Ronald Reagan. He signed into law a mandate that hospitals with emergency rooms must take in and treat anybody who shows up at their door, and the taxpayers pick up the tab. That was Ronald Reagan, that mandate. Others think that the individual mandate originated with the Heritage Foundation, which proposed mandating that we all buy health insurance from for-profit insurance companies. This was back in 1993, and it was their way of countering Bill and Hillary Clinton's health care proposal. Remember Hillary Care? And they said, well, we can't have that. Let's have, mandate. 20 Republican senators, by the way, co-sponsored the mandated coverage back in 1993 in the Senate that year, again, as a way of pushing out Hillary Care. That Heritage Foundation proposal, of course, was picked up by Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney and put into law in that state in 2004. It's called Romney Care. But the real origin of the health care mandates precedes Romney or Clinton. It all started out, as Harvard Law professor Dr. Einar Elhauge points out in an article for the New Republic, it all starts out in 1790. That's right, 1790. Not 1970, 1790. The president was George Washington. And 20 of the founders, men who signed the Declaration of Independence, were serving in Congress, along with several founders among Washington's cabinet, including Jefferson and Madison. President Washington proposed, and Congress passed, a law mandating that all companies that operated ships must purchase and provide at no cost health insurance for their seamen, which included both the cost of doctor's visits and drugs. 2 years later, still with President George Washington, now 17 members of Congress who were founders of the Republic, signers of the Declaration of Independence, Washington proposed and Congress passed a mandate that every able-bodied man in America buy and own a gun. This became particularly useful during the War of 1812, just, you know, a decade or so later, when Canada and England came all the way down and burned the White House. So not a single founder or framer objected to the government mandating that every male in the country had to buy something from a private company, a gun. Then in 1798, during the John Adams presidency, our second president of the United States, Congress took the health care mandate for seafaring men even further. It turned out that while the mandate that their employers give them insurance for doctors and drugs was working well, guys who worked on the oceans, their hospital stays weren't covered. So president and founder of this country, John Adams, proposed and Congress passed a law that mandated that the individual workers themselves buy a health insurance policy that would cover their hospital stays. Only four of the founders in Congress objected, and none of them objected on constitutional grounds. But even with that history, going back to the founders, who pretty much knew their original intent when they started this country, so-called originalist Antonin Scalia is determined to do his best to blow up anything that comes from a Democratic president. And the odds over at InTrade right now are at around 75% that Scalia will prevail and that the individual mandate is going to be knocked down on Thursday. So here's the good news. If Scalia does this, President Obama and the Democrats have an opportunity. They should take that concept that we're all in this together, which is the core concept of the mandate. It's the core concept of Obamacare. They should take it a step further. Our nation already has a single-payer health care system. It's worked great for generations. It's called Medicare. It is so beloved by its users that they show up regularly at Tea Party rallies with signs that say, keep your government hands off my Medicare. Medicare is already in place. It's already working. It's already tied into Social Security numbers. It's just for citizens, right? That will make the crazies happy. Ready to go for the rest of us who are not over 65. So real simple, what the president should do if the individual mandate is struck down, or any substantial parts of Obamacare are struck down on Thursday by the right-wingers on the Supreme Court, what he should do is propose a new health care bill that is one line long, just a single sentence, a one-piece-of-paper health care bill that says, quite simply, the eligibility age for Medicare of 65 years old shall be eliminated and all American citizens shall be covered by the program. End of sentence. Can you imagine him saying, I've got a law here, it's got one page, it's got one sentence. President Obama really did a great thing by pushing through Obamacare, which got all Americans realizing, or many Americans anyway, realizing that we're all in this together. There are shared costs. We need everybody to be able to participate in this thing so that we can cover the big risks. So if the Supreme Court is going to make it impossible for Congress and the President to accomplish national health care using our broken for-profit system, we already have the alternative. It's this high-quality, already functioning Medicare system. It's available to us. I mean, the only thing that's preventing everybody in America from being on Medicare is that there's this rule in the Medicare law that says you got to be 65 to qualify for it. Delete that rule. Bingo. You have a national single-payer health care system. And perhaps most importantly, and I really think this is a point I know from time to time, just a few blocks down the street here from us, down at the White House, they listen to this program. And I want to say to any Obama advisors who may be listening, if the president or any Democratic Party advisors, if the Democratic Party picks up what I'm suggesting and says, okay, Supreme Court has blown up Obamacare to the point where it won't work, so what we're going to suggest is reduce the eligibility age for Medicare to zero. People love Medicare. We're going to make it available to everybody in America. If you run with that into the fall, and the Republicans are running on Paul Ryan's proposal that Medicare be privatized, that everybody get a voucher, that they have to deal with banksters and criminals in the health insurance industry, the Democrats are going to sweep the board. They'll win in a landslide. So now might be a good time to call the White House comment line or call your local Democratic Party or call your member of Congress, particularly if they're a Democrat, and say, if, or be ready for Thursday if it happens, if Scalia succeeds in knocking down the mandate, go for Medicare.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And go fast. It's just, you know, the two things. Everybody get into Medicare and doing away with so-called free trade. Whoever does those two things is never going to lose an election.
I'm to spare your life if bloated premiums you'll pay. But if you can't afford this ransom, here is what I'll say.
If you can't afford this ransom, here is what you'll say. Yo-ho, yo-ho, go ahead and die. From shingles, very, very...
Oh, it's the Ron Paul plan. This is what Alan Grayson said. Okay, the Republican plan is... A, don't get sick. B, if you do get sick, die quickly, because otherwise it's going to wipe out you and your family. That's the Republican health care plan. Mickey in Chamberlain, South Dakota. Hey, Mickey, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Thank you for everything that you do. I truly appreciate it. I've been listening to you forever. I used to live out in Oregon.
Oh, great.
And moved back home here to Chamberlain. My mom actually has lung cancer. She was diagnosed last year in March. But I wanted to mention, to go along with that, she has another single payer. She is eligible actually for Medicare, but she doesn't need that right now because she also is covered under her benefits as a member of the Crow Creek Sioux Tribe.
Wow.
IHS, take care of everything, has taken care of everything with all her chemo and radiation, hospital stays, Medicaid medicines. We, you know, they have a pharmacy up there. Not every reservation has a hospital. They don't have a hospital, but they have a pharmacy and a clinic that she can call in the morning, and they will, if it's an emergency, they'll obviously take her right away, or she can go to the emergency room at the hospital in Chamberlain, and then we just let them know, and then they take care of the bill.
Now, this is through the Indian Health Services?
Correct, yes.
The IHS? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I was unaware of that. So is that true of every Native American in the United States who qualifies to have that registration card? I forget the name of it.
As an enrolled member of yes, there are different
tribes,
and I can go up there as her daughter.
Mm-hmm.
I'm enrolled with my father's tribe in at Standing Rock,
uh-huh.
Sioux Tribe, but I can go up to IHS in Fort Thompson, which is 26 miles away from Chamberlain,
right.
And I can also get my basic medical care. And if I needed to go to the emergency room, I just need to let them know. And
yeah. So Native Americans in the United States have single payer health care.
Yes, correct, and it works very well.
And how long has it been there?
That. Oh gosh, as long as I can remember, and I know mm-hmm. there are certain tribes, like there's a hospital out in Rapid City, South Dakota, by Mount Rushmore.
Mm-hmm.
I forget the name of it offhand. Susan. Any Native American can go there and get anything taken care of. Basically, there's another one in Rosebud, South Dakota,
right.
Where and I think even non-native can go to the one in Rosebud. If my dad is very, I've gotten him XM and he gets to listen to you. He loves you too.
Well, thank you.
So
that's great. That is great.
Yeah, there are all kinds of things that people don't know about as far as single payer or universal type healthcare, and they work. And
yeah.
You don't have to wait months and months. If it's an emergency, it's taken care of.
Well, it's like TRICARE for our military. Our military and
yes.
retired military have single payer healthcare, right? And
exactly.
Native Americans have single payer healthcare, and people over 65 have single payer healthcare. And increasingly, it's like there's just this small pool of people left who don't have single payer healthcare, right? It's people who've
exactly.
never been in the military, who are not Native Americans, and who are not over 65. And it's
yes.
like, Time to bring us all together here.
It is. It's so sad. I have a friend who's 35, and he's afraid to go to the doctor in case he finds something and before he gets insurance.
Right.
Because he works. He has a full-time job, but they don't offer insurance. And
yeah.
he's afraid to go. He's a smoker.
Oh,
he's
my.
Afraid to go because he thinks, well, what if they find something, and then I will have, you know, a pre-existing condition. And although, you know, if any of that Obamacare is stricken down, then that may...
Right.
Not help him anyway. So
yeah,
it's just so bad.
We have such a
don't know about these things.
Such a messed up system here, Mickey. It is such a messed up system. It is just insane that it has been allowed to fester like this all these years. You know, going back to Nixon's original idea of, well, let's figure out a way that, you know, he allowed HMOs because somebody
mm-hmm.
could make a profit on it. It's
yep.
just absolutely bizarre. Mickey, thank you for the call and thanks for enlightening me and all of our viewers and listeners. It's much appreciated.
Thank you.
Teresa in Moscow, Maine. Hey, Teresa, what's up?
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. What's on your mind?
You had a woman on there who was talking about slavery, and
mm-hmm.
you said you didn't have a word for it.
Okay.
And my word is involuntary servitude.
Well, that's a good one. That's a good one. The... indentured servants would be another one. That's a lot of people came to the United States as indentured servants, both
same
from
thing.
Asia and from Europe in the 18th and 19th centuries. Yeah, yeah. And basically, the word that I would probably use is serf, S-E-R-F, because what we are looking at is a new era of feudalism, and we're reaching the point, you know, in order to be a serf, you basically had no net worth. You had no assets. And so functionally, the Lord owned you and everything that you had. And,
well,
you know,
we are working for our land and our right to live off the land, which we cannot
yeah.
any longer.
That's right. And if you look at somebody who's got, you know, whose house is underwater to the tune of $30,000 and all the assets that they have in the world, their clothing, furniture and everything all adds up to $30,000, their net worth is zero or minus. So they're serfs. And this is the tragedy of Reaganomics. It has just devastated this nation. Thank you very much, Teresa, for the call. I appreciate it. David in Santa Fe, you wanted to correct something about Native Americans?
Oh, I didn't want to correct anything. I'm also from South Dakota, but I live in Santa Fe now.
Uh-huh.
And I was born on the Rosebud Reservation.
Uh-huh.
And I lived in California, you know, part of the time, too. Here in Santa Fe, there's a hospital, Indian Health Service, but I only get partial services because I'm not on my reservation, so-called.
I see.
In California, you get nothing because Reagan did close all the Indian Health Service hospitals long ago.
As governor?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so there hasn't been Indian Health Service hospitals. Are there some clinics there?
Right.
But they closed those a long time ago.
That's
amazing.
There's
one facility way in downtown L.A.
The damage that that man did to this country. Thank you, David, for the enlightenment, and thank you for the call. I appreciate it. 28 minutes past the hour. We will be back. Step by step, I am convinced if the Democrats pick this thing up and run with it, they are going to win in November, even if the Koch brothers spend $1 billion.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Even if the Koch brothers spend $2 billion, the Democrats run with this concept of health care for everybody, they will win. The good, the bad, and the very, very somnifugously ugly, brought to you by the Organic Wine Company, 1-888 Eco Wine. The good, Russell Donner. While the fate of health care in America rests in the hands of the Supreme Court, one Illinois doctor is doing all he can to provide Americans with a quality, affordable health care. Russell Donner is 87 years old and has been practicing medicine in Rushville, Illinois since 1955. He charges just $5 for doctor's visits, he's never taken a vacation, and he keeps his clinic open 7 days a week. Rising medical costs across America are causing many to go without proper health care and to skip regular doctor's appointments. In a time when health care reform is up in the air, it's nice to see Dr. Donner doing all he can to help the uninsured citizens of Rushville stay healthy. Let's hope the government and the Supreme Court do the same thing. The bad, the TSA. First came the Chertoff porno scanners, then the invasive and unnecessary pat-downs. Now to add to their list of security theater blunders, the TSA is illegally opening human remains, spilling them, and laughing about it. John Gross of Indianapolis was flying recently with the ashes of his grandfather in his carry-on luggage. When he got to the TSA checkpoint in a Florida airport, the TSA agents opened the ashes and spilled them on the ground. And rather than apologize or even help gather up the ashes, the agents just laughed. This is even more astounding considering TSA guidelines forbid agents from opening or handling human remains. They must go through x-rays instead. This despicable incident is maybe the best proof yet that airport security in America needs some serious reform. And the very, very ugly state officials from Alabama. A bizarre law from 1939 allows Alabama's sheriffs to keep any leftover money that is given to them by the state to feed prison inmates. So, as a result, there's a big incentive for sheriffs to give subpar food to prison inmates so they can pad their own wallets. For example, in 2009, former Sheriff Greg Bartlett was sent to jail after pocketing more than $200,000 of the state's money that was supposed to feed jail inmates. Somehow that law has yet to be repealed, with numerous attempts to change the law dying before they reach the governor's office. As we told you last week, all across America, prisoners are subjected to an extraordinary rate of sexual assaults and rapes. So in Alabama, a population that's already at risk of physical and sexual abuse is being denied the most basic of human necessities needed to survive, good food, just so a few people can get a little richer. And that is very, very ugly. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. Bill in Lymington, Maine. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Tom.
Yeah.
Geez, I'm so happy to talk to you. I love your show. I think you're a great guy.
Thank you. All the thanks and is just not necessary. You can just get right into things so we can...
All right, the heck with you. That then.
Okay.
All right.
It's kind of you. What's up?
Well, I'm calling about the Medicare thing. Mm-hmm. It's kind of interesting. I belonged to an HMO back in the 90s. I'm 67 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And when I belonged to the HMO... What's that?
No, you're still in the air.
Okay, I can't hear you. I couldn't hear you for a minute there.
I was listening.
Yeah. Well, I belonged to an HMO in the 90s. I met my doctor a grand total of one time.
Mm-hmm.
Never saw her again. Mm-hmm. And for 10 years, I belonged to the HMO. My blood pressure slowly climbed until, you know, I had to take medication part. But
right.
I had a heart attack about 6 years ago, and I was on Medicaid. You know, I crossed over the age line.
Right.
And I went to this hospital. I got first-class care. After that, I saw two doctors, my regular physician and my cardiac doctor.
Mm-hmm.
I just saw them several times, more than I've ever seen a doctor in my entire life.
Yeah, this is what I'm not old enough for Medicare, but both of my parents were, and I've seen over and over and over again people who are on Medicare who are like, wow, this is really cool. This really works well. I mean, you know, you can find things to complain about with any healthcare service, but it sure does be. And plus, you don't have to deal with the insurance company sending you letters for every single bill saying, please verify this. And if we don't hear from you, then we're going to bill you instead of paying it. And all these little games that the insurance companies play, and your doctor saying, well, I'm not sure I can. I got to call the insurance company, get the bill. All this other nonsense. It's amazing.
Right.
Bill, thanks for the call, and thanks for the validation. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you.
Very sad that we didn't go to single payer.
Yeah, well, the hope springs eternal, Bill. Thanks a lot for the call. Serafina in Arizona?
Serafina.
Serafina. My apologies.
Yes.
What's up?
I've been on hold for a couple of hours.
Oh,
that's
why?
Okay. Tom, I wanted to ask you if you were aware that there are lawsuits that have been filed by the Roman Catholic Church and some other churches against the section of Obama healthcare regarding birth control.
Yes, I am familiar
with
that.
You're aware?
I'm sorry, go ahead. Your question.
Nobody's going to force anybody to, you know, use it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what about separation of church and state?
Well, I think that what those provisions do is they do separate church and state. Basically what they say
is... I'm talking about these churches that are suing.
Oh, I see. Well, they have the right to sue. I don't think that they should have the right to maintain their tax exempt status and lobby, which they are aggressively
exactly.
doing,
and try
to influence the public dialogue. But go ahead.
They're doing it big time.
Yeah, and just so all of our viewers and our listeners know what we're talking about, there is a provision that says that if you are a church and you don't want to provide, you know, comprehensive health care to your employees of your church,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Then that's fine. You can say to women in your church, sorry, you're not going to be able to get birth control on this health insurance plan. You can
right.
do that if you're a church. However, if as a church you decide to start a steel mill down the street and all the profit from the steel mill is going to go to the church, or you decide to start a school or a hospital, or you decide to start a clothing manufacturing company, or you do anything that is stepping into the realm of commerce, of just normal commerce, where other people can compete with you on a as it is basis. Nobody's going to Walmart's never going to compete with a church on religion, right? Churches have a monopoly on religion. So as long as you're in the religion business, you can discriminate against women. But once you step out of that and you start competing with Walmart, or you start competing with American Hospital Association or whatever it may be, then at that point, you've got to conduct yourself by the rules of American commerce. You no longer have that religious exemption, even though you're a church. You're making money, you know, or you're doing good work or whatever you're doing outside of the realm of religion. And the churches are yelling and screaming about this, saying, wait a minute, you know, we should be able to hire people regardless of their religion, and inflict our religion on them, basically. And I disagree with that. I'm familiar with it. Serafina, thank you very much for the call. It's great to hear from you. Aaron in Malibu, California, you wanted to correct me about something? What happened?
Oh, when you were going over the Supreme Court ruling on Arizona
SB 1070. You were talking about the part that was upheld, and you stated that if people get arrested, that they're asked for their papers, it's much worse than that.
Yes, you're right. They can arrest you
for some other reason. You don't have to be cited or arrested.
That's right. They can.
They can demand your papers.
That's correct. If they believe that you are an illegal alien, they can demand proof that you are, or they can investigate you.
The way the Supreme Court portrayed it is that if you get stopped for something else because of some suspicion or your taillight is out, then they can ask for your papers.
Right.
So what people are saying right now is that's still going to be used to discriminate.
Yes, and in fact, when the case was originally litigated, John Roberts said right at the beginning of the arguments, he said, "We're not here to discuss racial profiling, are we?" And everybody was like, "No, we're not." And he's like, "Okay, so that will come up later, basically." And so by allowing this piece through, what the court has said is, okay, if the police forces around America use this in a way that doesn't include racial profiling, in other words, if they stop, you know, a white blonde-haired guy who's driving down the street and ask for his papers, maybe he's, you know, actually a citizen of Germany or something. Well, it doesn't matter. He could live anywhere in the world. But if there's no evidence that there's racial profiling going on, fine. But if it turns out that it's all Hispanic people that are getting busted, for example, then that's racial profiling, and this too will get overturned. I'm guessing, my personal conspiracy theory on this, Aaron, and thank you for correcting, because I did misstate that yesterday. I hadn't fully read the decision. My personal conspiracy theory on this is that the reason that John Roberts wanted to make it clear that they weren't going to litigate racial profiling, and therefore they could slip through a piece of Senate Bill 1070, you know, the Arizona Papers, Please law, was because he wanted to give some kind of small victory. It was obvious on its face Senate Bill 1070 was unconstitutional, but he wanted to give some small victory to the state of Arizona so that the Republicans could claim victory out of the Supreme Court. And so what he did was he let through a piece knowing that in the next term of the court, next year, somebody's going to bring a case saying, you know, I and these 400 other people were all racially profiled and asked for our papers, and then the court will knock it down and it'll be gone altogether. But this is such a hyper-partisan court. They are so into supporting the Republican agenda that I'm convinced that's why they did it. Aaron, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And how how we define the party that's never again going to lose an election. Two steps right after this.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the files of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
What I would give to have Leonard Cohen's voice. And I'm guessing at some point somebody said, that's a liability, you know, you don't sing all that well. Maybe nobody said that. I don't know. He's got him and Bob Dylan, the least likely singers on earth, and they are the most brilliant. Sam in Jacksonville, Florida. Hey, Sam, what's up?
Stan, first of all.
Stan, my apologies.
That's fine. I love your show. I haven't been able to call in for a while. I'm Stan Swart, among other things, a former health insurance salesman.
Okay. Oh, yeah. You've informed us about things in the past.
Been there, done that.
Yep.
But two things I want to make. First of all, when you're going back in the history earlier, you didn't go back quite far enough. Socialized medicine in our country, and really in the world maybe, started with George Washington as commander of the Continental Army. When he ordered that all his soldiers be inoculated for smallpox, he started socialized medicine, which continued for about 150 years when all children had to have it. Certain age, I admit, I was inoculated. You know, we mandated the smallpox inoculation, starting with Washington. And we did it for the whole country. And then when medicine changed, we didn't need to do it anymore, which is an advance forward. But
right.
I just think we need to notice that we've always had mandates, even going back to Washington and his soldiers.
I did not know that.
Feel free to check it out. I mean, I've seen it before.
Sure.
And again, we've moved backwards and forwards as medicine changes. But we also need to realize, as you pointed out, that health care, single-payer health care, is all over the country in different formats. And here's the thing. I know you have other people and you need to go on here. I want to, again, praise your show. And we hope to have you back on air down here before too long on a live show. Haven't had you on for about a year. But the whole issue of mandates. Has anybody ever read the first article in the U.S. Constitution where it says that Congress shall have the power to pass laws for the national defense and the general welfare?
Right, right.
It's right there.
Yep.
I know people don't like to talk about it, and it has been largely ignored directly for 200 years, but the fact is Congress has the power to pass legislation for the national defense and the general welfare.
You're absolutely right. Yep, well said. Thank you very much, Stan. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. David in Chicago. Hey, David, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Earlier you had that fellow on who was talking, speaking against minimum wage.
Yeah.
And he said that he didn't want the government setting, determining what that wage would be.
Mm-hmm.
And to some degree, he may have a point. And then you started to get real close to my thing, is that there is a mechanism already in place that works very well at setting that wage, and it's called a union contract.
Ah, yes. And this is, and you look at countries like Sweden that have, you know, 91 or 92 or 87%, whatever it is, it's in that range, unionization, or Germany, that's in that neighborhood. And you don't need a minimum wage law when you've got, you know, basically parity between labor and management in as much as virtually all of the large companies in Germany. It's every company with over 1,000 employees are fully unionized, and half the board of directors is union members, union representation. Excellent point, David. Thank you very much for calling and making it. Adam in New Orleans, Louisiana. Hey, Adam, what's on your mind?
Well, first I want to thank
Adam?
You for your program. I'll skip.
Can you speak up?
Can you hear me?
No, I can't. Adam, I'm really sorry. It's all busted up. I know you've been on hold for a long time, and I wanted to give you your say, but you got to call back with a different phone. Phyllis in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Phyllis.
Hi, Tom. Oh, great speaking to you. I was just kind of wondering if you have any opinion or knowledge about the Obama's TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, that I guess got pushed through Congress.
No, Congress hasn't seen it yet. It has been negotiated in secret with 600 corporate representatives and the administration, and they are going to present it in whole as a take-it-or-leave-it to Congress, or at least this is my understanding of it, at some point. And presumably that some point will be after the elections, because this will be very controversial. I'm not a fan of it. I'm not a fan of any of these trade agreements. I think all of them should be blown up. I think we should pull out of all of them. No longer be a member of the World Trade Organization and get out of NAFTA and CAFTA and SHAFTA and all of them. But, you know, my voice doesn't carry that much weight in the halls of Congress. So, Phyllis, I think the main thing we need to do is be vigilant and awake, you know, to let people know. So,
why does Obama seem to favor this?
Well, we don't know yet that he does, but if he does, it would not be inconsistent. Pretty much ever since Bill Clinton, the Democrats have been with the Republicans in favoring what they call free trade. And I think that it's a mistake. I think the Democrats should be standing up against free trade. And I hope to see the day when they do. But
yeah,
so far, they have been drinking that Kool-Aid that they've been reading Tom Friedman's books and stuff like that.
Okay,
Phyllis, thank you for the call. I've got to move along, but I appreciate the call. Elton in Lima, Ohio. Hey, Elton, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Real quick question. I know you're running toward the end here. With the American Indians having government-paid health care, if I look at the Civil Rights Act or the Equal Protection, isn't that discrimination against the rest of people based upon national origin, race, sex, and such?
If reservations are not U.S. territory, so no.
But the U.S. government is providing the health care, correct?
Right. And, you know, we're providing, arguably, we're providing health care to Egypt. We send them $3 billion a year. You know, I'm guessing some of that's paying for somebody's health care. In fact, the Constitution actually says that Congress can make treaties with the Indian tribes. And so, yeah, I don't think that it's unconstitutional at all. I think that a strong case can be made that if we're doing this for Native Americans, we should be doing it for everybody. I'm with you on that. But I don't think that you would find that you could successfully sue. Coming up next on the Tom Hartman Program, why are Republicans holding jobs hostage yet again? I'll challenge conservative Stephen Moore of the Wall Street Journal. Plus, conversations with great minds. He won an Academy Award for his film Inside Job. I'll speak with director-producer Charles Ferguson, author of the new book, Predator Nation. And the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week for we the people. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.